On this week's episode of The Freenooner, we are opening a rich grab bag of listener emails to find out what you want to know.
We look at the work of real hero speaking Drew Davis and his elegant systems for post-talk engagement.
And we enjoy the Webster family special take on a classic gin martini.
All that and more on this week's episode of The Freenooner.
So this episode, we hadn't planned this episode, but we have gotten so many great questions, really deep questions that I think, not the sort of like, what color pants do you wear on stage? Because we all know.
I don't wear pants
neither
on stage.
Neither one of us wears stage. But we have gotten some great questions. So I thought we would take a pause in the alleged narrative arc of the show.
Yes. And thanks to all those hashtag freenoters out there.
Thank you, hashtag freenoters. And if you have questions and would like your 15 seconds of fame here on The Freenooner, email us at thefreenooner@gmail.com. And while I'm making requests, if you would give us a review on the podcast platform of your choice, regardless of what that review is, we would love it.
But make it good.
100% five star. All right. So it's a grab bag, and we're going to start right off the top with a question that we touched on aspects of it, but Douglas is asking something a little bit more specific here, which I would love to dive into.
So tell me what it is.
Our friend Douglas Carr.
Oh, I love Douglas Carr.
He's a fine human. Shout out to Douglas
Carr. Yeah, fine human indeed.
Fine human. Indiana represent.
Absolutely.
And he asks, how do you balance freenoting and actually using the opportunity for garnering business without sounding like a jerk? And here's the question that I think we haven't spent as much time on. What's your call to action? Is it passive or aggressive?
Oh, so excellent, thought-provoking question.
Super question,
from
Douglas. Thank you.
And I err on the side of not passive, but not a direct sale offer either. So, you know, I would say what I would not do is like, and hey, by the way, talk to me after the talk if you want to work with me on this, like, or like act now and I'll give you a discount on X, Y, or Z. I think that's too aggressive, particularly in a situation where people haven't come to be sold to. And we've talked about this before. I'm a strong believer that there's kind of two mindsets that people come in. They either want to learn or they want to act. And most of the time when they're at a conference, they are still learning. And a aggressive call to action is forcing them over to the acting mode, and you don't get to do that. So I don't like to do a direct thing, but before I kind of talk about what I do, I'm curious, like, what's your initial take on what you do?
Well, I can only talk about what I do, as you say, because I have something that's a very kind of, you know, long sales cycle, can be expensive for depending on your size of your company and things like that. So when I speak, the general audience that I'm speaking to, I'm assuming are not my customers.
Yeah.
What I'm assuming is that they are people who are curious about the things that we are researching. And that if I present a credible enough picture about kind of our take on it and the facts that we have uncovered, that those will be accepted as currency data.
Yeah.
And, you know, I present a lot to agencies. I want our data to be taken into agencies and things like that by the people who come to see me speak, because it's going to be the agencies that hire me. They may not come to see me speak. And so I do have a clear action that I want the audience to take. It is absolutely, to use Douglas's terms, it's passive. And that is, I want them to use my data.
Right. And that's, and for one of the things we've talked about before, I mean, that's one of the ways that you can make your freenoting measurable, both to yourself and to your higher ups back in the office, is if you are very clear about what action you are expecting to have happen as a result of the talk, then you can actually measure that and you can see it happen. Now, but back to this kind of, you know, passive versus, you know, I think it's kind of overt or less, it's not covert ask, because what I find to be quite helpful is to tell people what the next steps are. But I'm always very careful. At least I try very hard to make sure I've set up a talk in such a way where, of course, I'd love for them to come do those next steps with me. And of course, yes, they can hire me to do that. And I usually use a Mitch Jolian phrase somewhere in the talk that says, when I work with clients on this, this is what it looks like. But I try to make sure that I have given them the steps that they could take on their own. And then what I try to do as a kind of a specific call to action is something that indicates a next level interest in those steps. So typically it's, I will offer folks, either notes from the talk or a worksheet that allows them to start with the process of what I've just talked about. And I don't want to get too quick into our real hero of speaking. Something that allows people to have a conversation with me afterwards. So I always try to do an indirect thing. So one of the things that I will do is a call to action from my talks sometimes. So worksheets are very common for me. Sometimes it's the written notes since my slides are not useful on their own typically. But something I've experimented with a couple times, and this is an idea I got from the spectacular Aaron Gargan King, is that sometimes what I'm offering as a call to action is sign up for a free webinar, like a week or two later, that either serves as a Q&A or shows them the exact process that I've talked about. If it's been more of a keynote level and I haven't really shown the how to piece of it. So that kind of Q&A a week later, that's been very effective. It's something that I include as a bonus, like when someone's paying me to keynote, like that's part of my fee. But if for whatever reason my fee doesn't fit their budget, then one of the things I will often still offer that, but then it's for me and I get all the names for the people who sign up.
Yeah. I try to, at my call to action, as it were, whenever I give a research talk is to, please use this research. And there are things that we absolutely track. We track, I always put our slides up on SlideShare. We track how many times they've been embedded in other presentations. Mm. We track how many times I get an email that says, can I use this slide in my company presentation? Can I use this slide in our investment newsletter?
That's great.
And when those increase, then I know that those are the metrics that really matter.
I always forget about SlideShare, probably because LinkedIn forgot about SlideShare.
I know. And it's kind of like a sneaky, huge channel for us. We have hundreds of thousands of like embeds and downloads and of our presentations. And like every time somebody embeds our presentation in something that they're doing, that's like a tacit acknowledgement that it's currency data for that. And that's our goal. So, but I mean, to be honest, like if I had to like give a talk where my end goal was at the end of this, you're going to call me and buy our research, like that wouldn't work. You have to understand what is it that the audience what is a realistic goal for the audience to actually do?
Yeah, exactly. And that's such an excellent point, because that really has to be what are they likely to do based on what you've just told them. And so what I like to do before I craft any talk, one thing that I always love to identify, and this is the thing that I work with on clients as well, is that I identify ahead of time what should the audience be able to do afterwards. And there's always one, because you want to make sure that the audience should be able to do one thing. And then typically my lead magnet or the offer that I'm giving them or the call to action, however it's made, is tied to that thing. So if I say, for instance, that, after like my getting the green light talk, a company should be able to identify whether or not they are predominantly green light or predominantly red light, then the offer that I'm giving them afterwards is, okay, here's how to put together a green light message. Here's a worksheet for doing that. I forget what's tied to either of them right now, but if our listeners want to just test and see how my lead magnet works, you can, to the number 66866, I've got two different ones. One is, text Tamsin. So you're going to, as if it were a phone number, do 66866. And then the message part, you're going to put Tamsin. And then you'll see how that works. Or you can also do Red Thread, all one word. You will not be automatically signed up to anything. I just want people to be able to see how a text to join kind of lead magnet can work and the kinds of things that I put on that.
Can I get super deep here for a minute?
Oh, baby. Yes.
Oh yeah. So at the heart of Douglas's question, what's your call to action? Is it passive or aggressive? is an existential question for what differentiates your brand in the first place. And what I mean here is that, so Douglas, our friend Douglas, is a digital marketer, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And
a lovely one.
And a lovely one, right? So there's two ways, if you're a digital marketer, to give a free note. One is, I sell digital marketing services. At the end of this talk, I would like you to buy my digital marketing services. Unlikely.
Right.
Unless it's a really like bottom of the funnel, you know, client conference kind of thing.
Yeah. Still unlikely.
It's still unlikely, right?
As a direct result, they're going to call you up and have right. you do that thing. Yeah.
But here is the passive call to action that is actually sneaky effective, right? I am a digital marketer. My unique take on digital marketing is that this thing is important. Would you like to know more about that thing? Like, are you curious about that? Right. Do I have a differentiated take on digital marketing that is ownable, somewhat unique? And I think at the end of a talk like that, your goal, a realistic goal, is not sign me up, digitally market my company, but it might be, oh, I never thought about attribution that way. I'd like to know more about that.
Right.
And if you have a stake in that space, they'll find you.
Yeah. And two points on that. One, this is exactly what we're talking about on our problem episode, the Duck Bunny, which was how to start thinking about how can you differentiate your place in the market and use that. The second thing is, I just want to come back to something we've said before too, which is everybody, you know, your mileage may vary, but don't bait and switch people. I can't stand it when people are like, and, you know, because I have seen people do this after, you know, and they'll bring you right up to the point of telling you how to do what they're doing. And they're like, and all right, well, I'm all done now. If you want to know more, then do the lead magnet, or then, you know, I'm here to chat with you out in the hall afterwards. And that's just crappy. Like,
it's crappy.
It's not crappy.
You need to deliver value in the talk itself, or you have wasted everybody's time.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me mad. It makes me mad anytime it happens, because people's time is valuable. They didn't come to get sold to. And when you do that, it's just cheap. And the thing is, like, it works. I've seen it work. I've seen people like go, oh, sign up. But it's just like, oh, I couldn't sleep at night if that's how I got people. Like, oh, but again, your mileage may vary.
But don't do it.
But don't do it.
Yeah, but don't do it.
But since this topic is so relevant, should we just go into our real hero of speaking for this week?
You mean mix up the order?
Absolutely. Can we do that?
No, actually, I want to hold off, because our final question is completely relevant to our real hero of speaking. I had a plan.
Okay. Well, let's go on to the next question.
All right. Our next question is from our friend Alan Stein.
Oh, I love Alan Stein.
Yeah, Alan.
I know. I'm like, apparently I love all of our listeners.
You do.
And I do.
Well, our next one, maybe you'll just say, or I will. Oh, we hate this person.
Oh,
I wish
they
weren't listening.
No, I'm so thrilled. I love the fact that people are asking us questions.
So, yeah, Alan is connected with both of us on Facebook, and he's a speaker. He has a book called Raise Your Game.
Yep.
And he played basketball for Elon. Yes. Elon University.
Yes, and he's also a client, so full disclosure.
And he's also a client of yours, but he's a great speaker on leadership and motivation, and is connected deeply with the world of basketball, which I am too, so I love that. He has a great question, because and I don't know if our listeners know this, so let me break this for the first time. Tamsin and I are married.
What?
Yes. When we turn the microphones off here, we are still going to look at each other for somewhere between hours and years.
Yes, that's true. I hope it's years.
I hope it's centuries, frankly. But Alan, knowing that, asked this great question. He asked, where do you two differ or disagree on speaking techniques and styles? And like, where do you two not actually fall into lockstep or agree with each other?
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, because it's actually, I really can't think of a place where philosophically we disagree about.
You're wrong.
I think there's a lot of stuff in process that we don't do. I mean, yeah. We've said this before. I'm relentlessly pattern driven. Like I also feel an obligation given the fact that I teach people my red thread method that I craft every piece of content and every talk through that. So I'm always going to take those steps, to prepare a talk. And I think, you know, so that's one thing that I would say. I think there's a lot, I do a lot more, committing things to paper or slides before I give the talk than you. I would also say that you and I, we both use slides, but we actually use them quite differently. And I think a lot of that has to do with content. I mean, I think we use them fairly similarly when, you're not giving as research heavy a talk. But yeah, we have, I mean, some different approaches there, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on where we differ and disagree.
I think we violently disagree on speaking.
Really?
Oh.
I think so.
No, and I will say this. I don't just love the red thread process. I married it, reader. and I use it for new keynotes and high stakes things. But I give dozens and dozens of kind of one-off research presentations, and they don't necessarily get that treatment. And
but you've also, I mean, so our listeners should know that you, have a master's in English.
Yes.
And
I taught rhetoric.
And you taught rhetoric. Yeah. And so you are someone who I think is unconsciously competent, in structure and storytelling, not to mention your years and years and years of focus group, facilitation, which I think naturally gives you a sense of what is and isn't going to work in an audience, which, I mean, you've gotten your 10,000 hours in a different place, which I think, you know, I think I don't want people to go, oh, he's just magical. I mean, you are magical, baby. I think so.
Oh, yeah.
But I think a huge amount of your ability to just like, without as much preparation as some other people might do, you actually can go in and do that really, really well. But I will also say, you never wing it.
I don't ever wing
it. You never wing it because you just don't sleep the night before.
No, and I think this, Alan, to get to the heart of your question, it's not so much a difference in speaking styles. It is what makes Tamsin and I as different as different can be. It's our biggest difference, I think, 100%. Like, you know, we are in lockstep on so many things, but I am very much an internal processor of things, and Tamsin is an external processor of things. And when we are both working on talks, like during the day, Tamsin will be bouncing things off of me,
constantly.
not to get my advice, but just to vocalize,
just to hear it out loud. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And when I am working on a big talk, nothing.
He's absolutely silent. And I only hear about it when you're struggling with something. I mean, and so, there are those moments where you're like, I can't, this part's tough. And then usually it doesn't take much to solve that. But I think, yeah, you're right. That the difference between you kind of do all of this internally. And for me, I am such an external processor. Yeah. Like I have to talk things through, that's how it is. And in fact, it's probably why, I mean, you give a whole bunch of different talks. I give a whole bunch of different variations on the same talk because I am constantly tinkering with format and variation and words. Even if the fundamental structure and the fundamental message of a talk of mine stays the same, I keep tweaking until I find the one that works. And I think probably the most painful part for me is when I can feel a new one coming out and I kind of want to introduce those new pieces into the old talk, but the old talk is tight the way it is. So I don't want to like mess it up. That's always hard. That's hard for me. But I think that's just one of those different, that's a difference in situation in that case, and less a difference of approach.
Yeah. I mean, I've given so many talks at marketing conferences and, you know, I've told people that, oh, this is the first time I've given this. And they've been like, oh, really? Wow. But actually not only is it the first time I've given it, it might be the last time I've given it. And it's been rehearsed in my head from like 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. every morning until I can finally sleep. And that's when it happens.
And I can attest to this.
Yeah. I will wake up at 2 a.m. and I will give the talk in my head. And I, you know, yes, I suppose, your acting coach will tell you that that's not necessarily stage rehearsal, but it works for me. And that's really what
matters.
How
the brain works, I think there's certain statistics put it at just visualizing and running through in your head lays about 70 to 80% of the mental pathways that actually doing it would. So it's a big thing. I'd say the other thing that's different is that, you know, that's in a contrast to your kind of internal preparation like that, is that for me, a huge amount of writing and my video recording is actually serves as rehearsal for me.
Yeah.
And that's
true.
Yeah. So I often will figure out how I'm going to say something in written form. And because I try very hard for my written stuff to sound like I talk, a lot of times it serves as a de facto script. So for instance, if you were to go back and look at the first time I wrote about the Semmelweis Nightingale duo story that I use in my Getting the Green Light talk, there's language that as performed is exactly the same, I think, as how I wrote it. Because I did all the work to figure out what was the best way to say it then. And so I think that's a thing that I do too. But it's another manifestation of that external processing.
So great question, Alan. If your question was intended to drive a wedge between us, it failed.
It did.
It did.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, I'm not sorry.
All right.
You and me, baby.
All right. We have a couple more questions here. Okay. Here's one from Mike Gill. And Mike Gill Ronan, actually. Mike Gill Ronan.
He's at Mike Gill on Twitter.
All right. At Mike Gill. Okay. Yep. Mike Gill Ronan.
Yep.
Thanks for that.
Sure.
And he wrote, curious if you and I have ideas or thoughts about the sketchnoting trend from either a presenter or consumer point of view. So what's sketchnoting, Tamsin? You've had this done more than I have.
Yeah, absolutely. So sketchnoting is when the conference hires someone to take visual notes while you're speaking. And so usually it's some big piece of white foam core and they've got multi colors of markers and they are it's not so much like a comic book thing, but it's kind of like, imagine like a mind map and a comic book, like had a baby about your talk. Like that's what that is. Oftentimes they have that person, you know, as extra visual interest next to the stage doing it, which I despise, mind you.
100%.
Because it can be incredibly distracting because the audience just ends up watching what the sketch noter is doing. So I much prefer it when the sketch noter is like at the back and then it's like this extra treat where the audience discovers afterwards that these notes have been taken. So I think it's a really fascinating thing, because I think it's a great thing for the audience. I think it's a wonderful thing for event organizers to do, to have this extra experience for the audience. I think we as speakers like to be able to have a picture that we can take as well. Content Marketing World, which is an event that you and I both love, definitely a free noting event. But they have for several years now brought in, Kelly Kingman and her company, Kingman Inc., who I think unabashedly are the best ones at
this.
Yeah,
best I've seen.
More consistently able to actually capture the major points of a talk in a way that's coherent afterwards on that. Because I've seen a bunch of these sketch notes, even with talks that are well constructed, that it's just like, why did you pick that? But what Content Marketing World has done for a couple of years, or 1 year, what they did was they took a picture of the sketch note that Kingman Inc. did and then sent it to us as a speaker gift, which was lovely. So I think it's a great experience for both speakers and audience. It's kind of a fun way to capture notes. But what's your take on them?
Well, I agree that I don't want them in the front of the room. And I've spoken at many events where they are at the front of the room, right? So, I mean, just imagine you are on stage. Behind you is a screen with your slides. And to the left or to the right of you, off stage, is someone trying to describe what is on your screen and your slides and in your talk. It's too many notes. It's too many things to watch. It's a detriment to the performance. It's a detriment to comprehension. Like, I don't mind it when it's at the back of the room. I really don't. But it, you know, in some ways, and, you know, Kingman does a great job. Your mileage may vary on that. You could probably do a better job with a handout. You know, if the goal is to get something that captures the gist of your talk, and that your choices are somebody coming in doing a sketch note or something provided by the speaker that is an outline of the talk, I'm going to go B every time.
100%. Oh my Lord, do I love handouts. Handouts And audiences love handouts too.
Audiences love handouts.
They really do. And I've had certain events go unnamed who were like, well, you can't have a handout. I'm like, well, what do you mean I can't have a handout?
Of course I can have a handout.
Well, but they're like, well, we're not going to do any paper. Right. I know. But like in my mind, the best handouts, you actually give them out before the talk. And some people are like, why would you do that? Because wouldn't that distract? I'm like, dude, if you people are distracted by your handout and not listening to you, you have bigger problems.
Amen.
Amen.
Amen, sister, wife.
I just preached it. Wait, I am not a sister wife. Is there something I should know?
We'll talk.
Yeah. Well, you brought up an interesting point earlier before we turned the recorder on that talked about the sketchnote actually offered an opportunity for a speaker to learn more about what people take away from their talk. So tell us more about that.
Yeah. So let's say that you are giving a talk and Kingman is doing it, which we both agree. I think she does a really great job. And what you see on the sketch note, this tableau of visual notes about what you talked about, is not what you thought you talked about, or it does not hit the points that you talked about. You know, maybe it's you.
Yeah.
And to me, if you are, again, I don't want it in the front of the room, but if someone is doing it off stage in the back of the room and they're writing down what they believe your main takeaways are, and their version of your main takeaways are not your version of your main takeaways, it's not their fault.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's really not. I mean, I think it's a good thing to like, and if you look at it, you're like, that's not my talk. A great way to validate it, if it's a tweeting or social audience, is go look at Twitter and Instagram and see what resonated. Because what people take pictures of, what they quote from you, et cetera, a really great way to understand what about your message didn't resonate. So it's a great way to check a sketch note. And I think I always look at that because I most often speak to marketing audiences and I use slides actively. And so I'm always intrigued by what are the phrases, what are the concepts that really resonate for people? Because those are the ones that, you know, over time, as I'm continuing to tinker with talks, like I will start to lift up those concepts even more because I know that they resonate. And so that helps tell me where I should spend more time because those are the things that people want to know more about.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good, like I said, it's always good to get that some form of feedback on your talk. And I think a sketch note can be an interesting way to do that.
I think one of the things that I really admire about your presentations and slides, and slides is coming up in the next episode. Woo-hoo! So we're going to get there, is that your slides are predominantly visuals, except for the points you really want to land.
Yeah, that's
which you are really explicit about.
Yes,
right?
I'm very
clear. And I know our friend Chris Penn will often put in slides that actually have the Twitter symbol next to it with like verbatim text. This is what you should tweet. And honestly, here's something.
I'm not quite that overt, but I make sure that they're very tweetable in both their visual construction and their length. So, yeah.
Well, that's one thing. You know, we do a big research webinar every year, a really big research webinar every year called The Infinite Dial. And after years of watching people kind of take their own spin and twist, even as clear as we think we were on what a data point means, we just started being really clear, like simultaneously when we give the data point, tweeting out a visual of the slide and exactly what that slide means. And most people will just retweet that instead of doing their own interpretation of it. Yeah. And you sort of have to do that, I think. But, you know, again, I don't want to obscure the point that I want to make here, which is if your sketchnote artist seems like they attended a different talk than your talk, it might not be their fault.
There's one more thing you can do. Now, this doesn't get you out of the hole of like, you've got a crappy, disorganized, as I like to call, tipsy talk, which I don't think we've talked about.
We've
too
not
much
talked about tipsy talks. I love tipsy talks.
So just quick reference here. Tipsy talks are what I call those talks that are just full of nuggets and there's no narrative theme whatsoever, except maybe the title.
50 ways to improve your email marketing in 50 minutes.
And the thing is, like, just like a good cocktail that gets you tipsy, like audiences adore them and then they immediately forget everything the next day. It's like, just like when you get tipsy, it feels fun at the moment and you hope to forget everything the next day.
I've never been that.
Yeah. But a tipsy talk, like, So a sketch note can't save you from this, but the technique I want to tell people about is that oftentimes the sketch note artist, I've had a couple of them ask me ahead of time, but this is, I think, something you can ask for. If you know that there's going to be a sketch note artist at your talk, ask if you can talk with them in advance, and you can essentially educate them in advance about what the talk is about and what the main points are. Again, it doesn't let you off the hook for doing the great job, making sure that there's a clear narrative, logical, emotional arc to your talk. But it can also make sure that they don't somehow miss something super important because they decided they were going to do this amazing illustration of a dodo bird because you mention it in passing and they miss your big point because they're still filling in the freaking feathers on the dodo bird. Because I've had that happen, except it was a minotaur. But that's okay. I'm not bitter.
You're not bitter?
I'm a little bit bitter.
You sure? I think you're a little bitter.
Maybe a little bit.
All right. We have one last question today.
This, grab bag. It's fun. It is super fun.
So here's one from Sky Alphabet Social Media, at Sky Alphabet on the Twitter.
On the Twitters.
And you're on the Twitter.
I am. I'm at Tamadir. I am not at Tamsin Webster, sadly. I'm still trying to get that one.
Yeah.
But you and I both have original AOL.
Seriously, AOL.
Handles, which at Tamadir was my old AOL handle. It's a obscure Heinlein reference. And I think anyone who knows it,
They should get a prize.
They should get a prize.
Yeah. A Freenoter t-shirt when we make them.
I think Chris Farias, who designed our Freenoter.
Chris, shout out art. To Chris Farias.
Yes, I'm sure he could actually come up with. You know what?
That's,
if anyone, right. The first person who does know the reference to Tamadir and Robert Heinlein, we will figure out a way to get you a Freenoter
also,
t-shirt.
Also, how am I about to go to Podcast Movement in LA and I don't have a Freenoter t-shirt to. I'm a failure.
We can figure this out.
I'm a failure.
You're not.
You married a failure.
We have the technology, we have the art. And the technology.
We do.
So we've got the steam.
But we lack the will.
All right. What is the question?
All right. So Sky Alphabet asked, what is the most effective way to maintain contact with the audience after the presentation is over? Some presenters ask people to text them. Others want a tweet mention. Have you seen anything that is particularly effective? And then appropriately, he adds, cheers.
Yay. All right. Already are people.
Already are people.
Yeah. I mean, so the general approaches to that, I think the ones that are most distinctive and that are most useful that I hear in the circles of speakers that we talked about, I think the one that people are most familiar with and see the most right now is the text to join, which I mentioned earlier. I use the service joinbytext.com. Textiful is another one. Lead digits from lead pages is another one. Generally, you're success with that depends on what you are offering in exchange for the text, A. B, how clear you are that they are not going to be automatically signed up for something, and that needs to be true, by the way. And then C, making sure that you're giving people enough time and you're walking them through the steps for what they need to do. So the best person I ever saw at this was a wonderful speaker named Kendra Hall. Client needed, but she
client
was not
for
a,
me too.
She was not, she is a client for you too. That's right. But not, she was not a client at the time I saw her do this, but she just really stopped on her whole text to join slide. She really explained it. She's like, so this is what you put here. This is where you put there. And I see Jay Baer, who we've talked about before, say, take a picture of it. I got a great tip from, I forget whose tip it was, maybe Pam Slim, who suggested that even after you move past the text to join slide, that you put it in the footer of your slide, so that even if they don't get it that moment, they kind of continue to see, text Tamsin to 66866 or whatever it is. So the text to join is, I think, probably one of the most common ones right now. I know a number of people who get quite a bit of utility out of in presentation polling devices. I don't have at my fingertips, different ways that people do that. But a lot of times, in order to get those polling devices to work in the first place, to sign up, people have to give their email address. And so you have that email address. I just find increasingly people are super, super reticent to do anything that gives them, where they have to give their email address. Because they get a ton of email, they don't want to get automatically signed up for something. I got to tell you, you know, unless you're Anne Handley, who just gave a talk on awesome newsletters, like offering your newsletter as the payoff for your, like, that's not going to work. So it kind of comes back to what we were saying before with the call to action, like whatever you put, whatever you're doing to get an email address or something like that needs to be, whatever you're offering needs to be consistent with what the talk is about. But I'm curious what you've seen. And then I think we should talk about A Real Hero Speaking, because he does something really, really special. And I think
I don't think I'm particularly great at this. I mean, the one thing that I have done in the past, there are some research presentations that I will give over and over, and it'll be customized to the event, but the topic and the data will stay the same. And in the past, I have done things like, you know, go to edisonresearch.com/name of conference to get the slides. I don't do anything else there to put a gateway on that. It's merely just to track like how many people from this conference were interested in this. Some people might say, you know, go to yourcompany.com/name of conference to get the slides and ask for an email address. That fights against what we do. That fights against our goal, which is just to get that research out there as much as possible and get people to share it. But in some cases, a gateway, you know, some kind of registration gate might make sense for you. But it's really easy to make a landing page and, you know, yoursite.com/name of conference. And if you do nothing else but just track how many people from each conference get the slides, that gives you at least a take on engagement.
Totally. And one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is, there we go. So one of the brilliant solutions for this that Chris Penn and his company Trust Insights have come up with is that, and he's done this for a long time now, is that he owns the URL wherecanigettheslides.com.
I know, that little stinker.
And if you go there, like you can see it, like he has updated it for whoever presented last. So it's between him and Katie and then John Wall are the three folks there that will speak. But you'll see that what, you know, how they set it up and what they do to kind of stay in touch. And I think he, like you, they often have data on the slides that people want hold of, right? And so I think that's a particularly good offer and a way to do it when you've got something that's useful. Is to kind of offer the slides if you've got great data that people want from the slides. But for some of us who are either that's not how we use our slides or the message is different, like the slides aren't actually that useful, which is why I love doing a handout as an offer. Like it's like, I get it. My slides are not detail heavy, but what I'll do is I'll offer the slides and a handout. And usually between the handout and the slides, it's enough. The other thing that I've offered in the past as an offer is a voiceover of the slides. So it's like, I'll do the slides, but I actually also record a voiceover of them so that they can go back to their office and kind of reproduce the effect of, you know, having heard that. So instead of just like, hey, I heard this person, you're like, no, actually here it is. Like I could actually, here's her giving the talk.
So this is a great moment to bring up this week's Real Hero of Speaking, one of the most methodical and systems-driven speakers that we know. Like, he's a machine.
He is a machine. I'm not sure he sleeps.
I know he wakes up much, much earlier than we do.
I don't have a clear sense of when he goes to bed, so I think he exists by...
In the nether plains.
Yes. I think he photosynthesizes sun, like a plant.
And we're talking about our friend Drew Davis, who has a lot to teach us.
Absolutely.
About systematically approaching a market. And he's a paid keynoter, although part of his plan sometimes is to be a free noter to get into a vertical.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
He's deep.
So much to learn from him. But I think when we were talking about this idea of what can you do to stay in touch with people afterwards, I mean, Drew is somebody who's tested a lot of these different lead magnets and offers and whatever. And what he has discovered is that he actually doesn't do anything, text to join, whatever. What he's found that's useful for him, because he's very clear on what his his ROI on his talks is what he calls stage side leads. He wants every talk he gives to generate at least 3 other talks. So like he's a full-time paid keynoter. There's not a consulting practice behind what he does. He speaks 100% of the time. And so what he's always trying to do is get more talks. So his way of staying in touch with people is based on that as the outcome. So bear that in mind. So what he has found to be the most valuable offer for people is his book. And so instead of saying, hey, here's a discount to the book or whatever, at least the last time I heard him speak about it, what he does is offers from the stage that anyone, he'll tell people, I'll be out in the hall immediately afterwards. If you come, give me your business card, I will send you a copy of the book that is related to whatever he just talked about. And he takes on for himself the work of taking those addresses in, sending those things out, et cetera. But he does that for a very specific reason. A, the book is perceived to be valuable enough that people will go do that. They're willing, that is a trade of information for value that they're willing to do. And he's tested, like I said, he's tested other things, other giveaways, whatever the books are the most valuable for him. The other thing that he does that he finds it's important by saying, I'm going to be at a certain place, is that it lines people up. And what he discovers happens when people line up to wait to talk to him, to give him their business card so they can get a copy of the book, is they start to talk to each other about the talk he just gave. And they start to convince themselves even more about how fantastic it was. And so what he's just found is that it creates this additional self-reinforcing buzz about him that he gets tons of people taking him up on that offer. And then by the time they've waited in line, they're actually even more sold on him. And so when he then follows up, which he does, like with an email campaign, a nurturing campaign, but again, in Drew's, this is not like a depersonalized thing. Like he's gone the extra mile.
Yeah.
He does the work. It's super effective. And so he's able to get those quote unquote stage side leads, and he's able to get those referrals and those additional gigs like every time he talks. I think there's certain big takeaways from that, but I'm curious, what do you take as the big takeaways kind of from everything we've talked about what to do, like to answer that question from Sky?
Yeah. I admire what Drew does. I think I don't do as good a job as Drew at the actual, like, here's a person I shook hands with on the side of the stage. How do I follow up on that? When I talk at conferences that are related to the research that I'm doing, I will get 5 to 7 stage side leads, and I'll give them my card, I'll take their card, and we'll see what happens from that. I mean, a lot of it is just matching up the right audience. And I think one of the things that Drew does that I admire so much is he dives deep on a specific vertical. And so he learns a lot. He spends like a block of time, like months or year, on a specific vertical, travel, construction, or whatever. And so when people approach him stage side, it's not just, here's my card. It's, I've read about what you're going through, or I understand your problem, because he really does.
Yeah. I mean, the other person who does a fantastic job at this, like particularly with what they do with the business cards afterwards, is, my dear, dear friend, Neen James. Because she has a whole system, and that makes sense because she's all about systems of attention, about what she does when someone gives her a business card after a talk. And so she has a whole system of collecting those cards, of what she sends to them afterwards, what she does for them afterwards. And so she really, really follows up. And I got to tell you, like, I don't do that. I'm very clear with people. I'm here's my card. Because for me, it's a little bit of pre-qualifying too, because it's like, here's my card. I know if you actually reach out to me later, then you're actually interested, and I don't have to. I'm sure that I'm missing folks by not like collecting and then following up from there. But, as a solopreneur on this, and it's pretty much, it's just up to what I and, my business manager, Jen, can do. At this point, it's still kind of minimizing that extra admin. But I think the models for that are absolutely Drew and Neen. I mean, they do, both of them do an amazing job. So maybe we can have a joint Real Heroes of Speaking this week.
We just did.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I hear you on qualifying, because I get a lot of emails from people who either want our research or want to pick my brain. And so when I get a business card at the side of the stage, if it's from a company that I know we have like strategically targeted I'm going to be in their office for lunch. Like, but yeah. In most cases, I give them my card and I see if they will reach out to me. Because again, you know, we have a long sales cycle. It's not exactly a $50 product that we sell. So if they do reach out, I take it seriously. But it really depends on what is your point of sale selling price? What is your sales cycle? You got to think about all that stuff and how much contact can you take, you know, in terms of unqualified leads before you start to really get your eye off the ball. And that's something I think about a lot.
Yeah. I think that's a huge consideration. But you know something that helps you keep your eye on the ball?
Gin.
Exactly right.
100%.
Yes.
So I am delighted for this week's pellet.
Yes.
The pellet, the thing that, you know, when the rat gets through the maze and pushes the lever, it does the job, you get the pellet.
And as always, thanks to Nilofer Merchant for the concept and the name.
I am a martini drinker, and you were not a martini drinker before you met me.
I was not, 100% not. Like, I was absolutely in the, you know, if there's two types of people in the world, like martini and Manhattan, then I still am a Manhattan drinker.
See-through and brown.
But you have turned my head with this particular martini, which I'm a big, big fan of.
Well, so I first of all, a martini is made with gin. Let's establish that. Like, I'm sorry to say, longtime listeners, you're not going to hear any vodka drinks on this show, because vodka is the thing that you add to something you'd rather drink to make it alcoholic.
But there is a vodka you like.
There's one, but it has a taste, and most vodkas don't. So
that's true.
That's an,
all right. The other thing is, just because it's served in a martini glass does not make it a martini.
No. God, no.
You remember that time we were on that cruise, and they were like, martini glass, and it was all like, it had like, there was drinks with blue curacao
guava.
In it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you're if it has blue curacao in it, it is not a martini.
So I love a classic martini, and I love it with olives. I love it with a twist. I only love it with gin.
So how did you come up with this one? Because it's super. And like, what made you come up with this one?
I don't know. I don't even remember. But I'll tell you two things about a martini. Like, when someone wants a gin martini, and they say, like, I want it super dry, like, just wave the vermouth bottle over the glass. That's a glass of gin.
That's, yeah.
It is nasty.
You can tell yourself whatever you want to about that, but, like, you were just down to 3 ounces
shots.
Of gin right there.
Just doing shots, right?
Exactly.
But the
slow shot.
A slow, slow shot. But the average, so a martini is made with gin and vermouth, and it's typically, long time ago, it was a 2-to-1 ratio, then it became a 3-to-1 ratio. And today, if you like go into JP McBeer's and order a martini, it's going to be just 3 ounces of gin.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I think the optimal, I think New York Times did an article on this. It was like, it's like 5 to 6 parts to one.
Yeah.
Though there are like, you know, the hipster bars are doing 50-50 right now. But
here's the thing. So the gin is one thing. The other component of a martini is the vermouth. Yeah. And most vermouth is just nasty, nasty, cheap wine.
Bad wine.
Bad wine. Cooking wine.
Shitty. Ooh.
So there goes our rating. Yeah, cheap ass wine. Let's go ahead and earn that
sheepy
mature. And so I just in experimentation wanted to get around that, because you can't just drink a glass of cold gin unless you're really
sad.
You're committed to despair.
You're in the slough of despond.
You're in the slough of despond, exactly. But yet. Gin needs something to sort of open it up and not be so hot. So what I came up with years ago, which we now call the Webster Martini, is a martini made with 3 ounces of Plymouth gin, which to my mind is the greatest martini gin.
Yeah, it's a great neutral gin.
It's very neutral. Yeah. It does not have a distinct flavor. It has just a basic sort of junipery, piney, but subtle flavor. And then, just so you don't feel like you are drinking a glass of gin, we use Saint Germain in this, and it's not like the
well, tell
same.
Tell the listeners what Saint Germain is.
Saint Germain is an elderflower liqueur. There are a few elderflower liqueurs out there. You kind of want Saint Germain for
this.
Yeah,
the other ones are not good.
No, they're not good. They're either too sweet or too medicinal, and Saint Germain is great. But you don't want to put in as much Saint Germain as you would vermouth, because it becomes too sweet. Because here's the thing. You don't want to actually taste the Saint Germain. If you taste the Saint Germain, it becomes a sweet drink.
Yeah.
So what I use is 3 ounces of Plymouth and then a cap full. And I mean, if you buy the bottle of Saint Germain, it has a cap. a capful of Saint Germain. That is your measure. 3 ounces of gin, a capful of Saint Germain.
I mean, adjust up or down to taste, but yeah. But it's really, you know, if I'm ordering it in a bar, for instance, I'll say, and enough Saint Germain just to take the heat off the gin.
That's exactly right.
And a great bartender will do that. But I mean, I love this. Like, I mean,
you're soaking in it, as we like to say.
Take me away. It is for people who don't think they like gin or don't think they like martinis. I think it's a delicious drink.
It is. Yeah. And very drinkable.
And you serve it up with a twist.
I serve it up with a twist. So I stir it for, you know, one thing about martinis is like, you don't shake a gin martini. Don't shake anything that doesn't have fruit juice in it.
F you, James Bond.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, I think the current James Bond gets them stirred. I don't know. Well, no, he doesn't, does he? He got them shaken. Yeah. Shake things with fruit juice. Don't shake things without fruit juice. And you can tell if it's cloudy, it's been shaken and ruined.
Yes, they bruised the gin.
They bruised the gin. So yes, you stir it for about 30 seconds because ideally that 3 ounces of gin should become 3.5 ounces of gin and water. And a martini is actually a case where you want to, quote unquote, water down your drink.
Mm, yep.
Very, very important because gin can be,
you know, quite hot. Other night I was at a bar and someone asked for what was known as the dirty ice. And I've never heard that before. And I was like, oh, that's brilliant. Like for whatever reason, they wanted to like, they had the drink served up neat, but they had the quote unquote dirty ice served next to it, which
like as in a sidecar.
Yeah.
Kind of
So it was like, it was the ice in which the drink had been mixed.
Huh.
So this person kind of like, as they chose to kind of extend the drink overnight, like added the dirty ice, which I, that little tip, I hadn't ever heard of that
is
before.
A great little tip. Yeah. So there you go. So 3 ounces of Plymouth gin, a capful of Saint Germain, stirred over ice for a good 30 seconds.
And toast us when you drink it.
And toast and strained with a twist.
Exactly.
And toast us when you drink it.
To the freenoters.
To the freenoters. And you know what? That's the end of this show.
That was a good show.
This was a good show. I mean, I know.
Our listeners will decide.
I trust them. So next week, we're going to tackle something that a lot of people have talked to us about. It's time to look at slides.
Oh, that's a good pun.
I know. It's time to look at slides. Do you need slides?
No.
How do you make slides work?
Lots of ways.
Okay, that's our show.
No, this is a, I can totally geek out.
This is a deep topic. It you is. And I use slides in very different ways.
We do. And I can totally geek out on this. And I have some very firm opinions on about how you can use slides in a way that, I don't know. I seem to have a different approach to slides than most other people. And yet it really works well for me. So I'm excited to talk about it.
We'll find out on next week's episode of The Freenoter. It's time to look at slides.
Such a good pun.
I know, right?
It was good.
It was good, right? Do you need slides? How do you make them work for you? And how do you make them not work against you?
Well, we'll also take a look at how real hero of speaking Joey Coleman builds slides to create momentum and engagement. And I'll give you a tip right now. It's a lot of slides.
It's a lot of slides. I know. His technique is really interesting.
It is.
And we will toast PowerPoint with a twist on a classic that we're going to call the slide car.
Oh, I love it. All this and more on next week's episode of The Freenoter. Cheers.
Cheers.